Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The opioid epidemic is not in the headlines like it used to be, but the community health threat has not gone away. It continues to be problematic for young people in our schools and adults who struggle with addiction. Tonight, on Medical Monday, we discuss how fentanyl mixed with cocaine and meth is creating a much more complex problem. My guests are Dr. Shana Wade, Project Manager for the Howard University College of Medicine Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Gloria Kane, Licensed Medical Social Worker in the Howard University School of Social Work, and Daphne Jordan, Peer Recovery Specialist. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call. I know you want to talk about it, and it is important that we do. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can X me at H Fisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Thank you all for joining the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Excuse me. So, before I get into the problem, and maybe, Daphne, you can help me with this, because you... As we know, you are recovering from drug abuse years and years ago, and now are in the unique position of having been there and also helping people who are still struggling with this. But for those of us who don't have addiction issues, who do not struggle with drug addiction, and maybe this is the naive question to ask. For those who are, what is it that they are looking for in their use and abuse of these drugs?
There is a feeling. It's a feeling disease. You know, a reason, I can just speak for myself, but I know it's with a lot of addicts. The reason we get high, because something happened to us in our life, and we weren't able to talk about it to somebody. So what we did was medicate ourselves. And when we got that first high, it made us feel good, so we kept on chasing that first high. But whatever the circumstance was, we wasn't feeling that problem that led us there. You know, like, for example, just say, like, I'm going to speak of myself. When I was young, like, I was raped, I was molested. You know, I had a happy family, but my dad was an alcoholic, and my mom was a workaholic. So it was a lot of dysfunctional going on in my home, you know, and I was touched by certain people in the family, and I couldn't tell nobody about it. So when we used to clean up the house behind parties, they had little ponies and beers, and I used to drink them. And as I got to drinking them, they started making me feel good, which started making me forget about what had happened to me. So I did the beer. So then I escalated to the weed, you know. And then from the weed, I did PCP, you know, and it just escalated because, you know, the weed was like, the beer started me, but the weed was a gateway drug. So once I realized that, you know, maybe the things that were bothering me and I couldn't talk to nobody about them, as long as I was high, I felt good. Mm. But when I came down off my high, then I started thinking about what somebody did to me again. So the weed started wearing off. So then I tried cocaine mixed with heroin. Mm. But the heroin, it kept making me nod. And I was like, why I keep nodding? Because I wanted to be up. I wanted to deal with my children. So it didn't take me long to leave the heroin alone.
Yeah.
But then I just got caught on that coke. And I stayed on it for 25 years, you know, and I had like 6 kids. And I couldn't really be the correct parent to my children, you know, like,
yeah.
Going to school, I got them through school for elementary, but I'm going to be seriously honest about it. I got lost with junior high and senior high with them, you know, because I wasn't the parent. I was getting high.
Yeah.
And I wasn't paying attention to what they was doing.
Daphne, you know? I will say, and I thank you for sharing that with us, because to be quite honest, in all the years that I've really kind of done this show, that is probably the most transparent description that I have heard from someone who could really explain to someone who does not know. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of us struggle in the midst of this fentanyl epidemic. You know, we don't understand a lot of times. We may see it, but we really don't understand. You know, Dr. Waits, in 2023, how would you characterize where we are regarding this opioid epidemic?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I think that it may not receive as much attention in the popular media, and there's a perception that it's still something that happens in suburbia, or that, you know, a lot of times I get the question of, why are we interested in this now? Why is all the funding, even research from the research perspective, going into it? But what's happening right now, as you mentioned, is the fentanyl crisis and the polysubstance use, meaning when we say polysubstance, that means when there's more than one substance combined. And so often, even people that aren't necessarily using heroin directly, they're getting that, or those opiates in cocaine and PCP, it's often laced and mixed with other substances, which is leading to the rise in the overdose. So right now, the district is leading right now in the rate of overdose-related deaths due to opioid.
And the perception that it's only happening out in the suburbs obviously is a misnomer, because all you have to really do is drive down Florida Avenue in North Capitol streets here in the District of Columbia, on Minnesota Avenue. It can happen obviously anywhere, but you don't have to drive, you know, too far to see it. And I guess, you know, Dr. Kane, the thing that mystifies me, as Daphne just said, she explained how it happened with her so many years ago. But now, when we're talking about, particularly in the schools, where there's so much information out there for young people, you know, this isn't, this will get you high. This stuff will kill you quickly. So why do you suspect that even with all of that information out there, that young people who may not heretofore have had any experience with, you know, drugs, perhaps maybe with the exception of alcohol, will do this knowing that it could kill them?
Well, one of the things that we are aware of is that, you know, peer pressure is, you know, a very strong factor and influence in, you know, children and adolescents, you know, trying illicit substances, even having the information that they could potentially be deadly. You know, they're still influenced by peers and also influenced by different, you know, modes of communication, such as social media and other types of, you know, communication mechanisms.
When we think about opioids, we've often thought about, you know, obviously pills, but what other kinds of, as you said, polysubstances. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Dr. Waits. You know, what are we seeing now? The mixtures, and where is this coming from?
You want to talk about
anyone? You know, talk your stuff.
Right. So I think that we've always known that a lot of people that have challenges with substance use are poly users, and a lot of the times they're not poly users intentionally. They may not necessarily know that the drugs that they might be taking or using could be laced with something else.
Daphne, would you agree with that? I know you mentioned PCP, and I know there was a time, you know, back in the day where here in the district, where if you thought you were getting weed, it was very likely that you could be getting weed laced with PCP. Is that still part of the issue today with fentanyl?
Yeah, it is, but a lot of people, and when you ask the question about why is the youth, the young out here doing it?
Yes, ma'am.
That comes from, like, I just thank God I got myself together. But if I didn't and I was still stuck in that lifestyle and I had kids, some of the parents are getting high with their child. Some of them are turning them on. You know what I'm saying? Because of the way they came up, maybe their parents turned them on. And sometimes, some days now, some of the parents are getting high right along with their child. I didn't have plenty of them, like me high with my mom. I was like, man, that would never happen. So I just thank God that I ain't using, because I couldn't really say. But some of them are getting high with their parents. And then some of them be, like a lot of these kids, they getting shot. And they go and they get this medication. And the medication is there to keep them from having pain. But they abuse it and they get hooked on it, right? So when they can't get the medication, some of them out here is looking for the fentanyl.
Mm.
They look. Some of them ask for fentanyl. If they don't have fentanyl, then they don't want it.
Mm.
When I go out in the community and I work, and someone can go out on fentanyl, and then they get hit with the Narcan, and they bring them around, and they ask me, do you want to go to the hospital? They say no. They be mad because you brought them out. But the person staying around to get off the same stuff they do will say, man, where you got that stuff from?
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the fourth wave of the opioid epidemic, fentanyl mixed with other drugs, cocaine and meth, how it is causing a much more complex problem when it comes to abuse of drugs. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You know, definitely just mentioned something that I found, you know, fascinating. And this is something that we know. I think it's common knowledge that often a lot of drug addictions for people who did not use or abuse drugs before come after a car accident where there is pain, where it may come from other kinds of incidents where they're seeking pain relief. And when those doctors give a limited amount of pain pills, and then afterwards they say, this is all you're going to get from now on, as you know, as you're going through this healing process, it's Motrin or Tylenol, that's all you're going to be able to take. But they begin to look for other things. When you interact, you know, Dr. Waits, with, you know, with patients who are struggling with this, what do they tell you?
Often I've seen, even as young as 18, 19, Ms. Daphne mentioned an additional point there, here with the high rates of violence that our youth are experiencing. I've seen quite a few youth that have had gunshot wounds and were exposed to taking opiates to treat the pain as they recover, and they end up in our hospital seeking inpatient detoxification treatment. But sometimes when you're dealing with that pain, and maybe you may not have the knowledge or awareness of other ways to manage that pain, or that you should be seeking out treatment with your physician about how to manage this pain outside of using opiates, people start seeking that. It also has street value. So sometimes people seek it because they can get money on the street for it, or they're buying it off the street. And that's another aspect of the overdose epidemic now, is that people, I think it's one out of four pills, what the DEA reported, one out of four pills are have fentanyl on it, or are laced with fentanyl. Or that one out of four are actually not, what am I trying to say, are synthetic or... Mm-hmm.
The prescription.
No, I was trying. I'm sorry, I lost my thought there. But yeah.
So you mentioned something that I am interested in hearing. You talked about detox and alternative ways to address with the pain. What does detox look like?
So when you go in for detoxification, so when people hear that term, they picture in the movies when people go in the hospital and they're shaking and sweating and
rolling around on
rolling the around and they're suffering. So. What part of that is, what when someone goes in for inpatient detox, it's usually a 2 to 3 day stint at the hospital where you're particularly if you're dealing with alcohol use disorder or opiate use disorder. There's medications that you're given or that you can have the option to take to help you deal with the withdrawal symptoms. So those things that you see in the movie when people are shaking and sweating and, you know, just seem like they're miserable.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you receive medical monitoring to help alleviate those symptoms, reduce your cravings, and cleanse the drugs out of your system.
And it also manages the withdrawal as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I want to drill down a little bit more on that because that part is fascinating. Also, Daphne, I have some more questions for you as to how you approach people who are addicted to move them in the right direction. I got a lot of questions, and I'm sure our listeners do too. Tracy calling from D.C., Jonathan calling from D.C. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue. I'm going to have you on the phone so that you can share your thoughts, ask your questions in just a bit. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That is on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, on this Medical Monday, we're talking about the fourth wave of the opioid crisis, how fentanyl mixed with cocaine or meth is creating a more complex problem. My guests are Dr. Shana Waits, manager of the Howard University College of Medicine Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health Services, Dr. Gloria Kane, licensed medical social worker in the Howard University School of Social Work, and Daphne Jordan, peer recovery specialist. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tracy, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Tracy. What's on your mind?
I was calling to say that a lot of young people are using not only some influence, but because a lot of times we don't feel like we fit in places, and so it's a lot of peer pressure, because I know when I was in fourth grade, I was forced to smoke drugs by an older guy. So there's a lot of things that factor in, but again, it's the family situation. If you don't have that dynamic, then the streets are waiting to gobble you up with other people who are already going through it that just want to put you right in the circle of it. So I think until we fix family dynamics and social dynamics, we're going to always have children trying to medicate what they feel, mm-hmm. because they don't understand. They haven't matured enough to deal with their emotions. So when they get a mood or mind altering drug, they're easily to get addicted because they don't care if they live or die, because a lot of times you're just that miserable in life. So until we can fix that, we're going to constantly have people not caring about checking out. So society has to do better towards each other so that families can thrive and that communities can grow too. Because without that, children aren't going to make it. I don't care what we do.
Tracy, thank you so much for your comments. Dr. Kane, you were nodding your head at what Tracy was saying.
So one of the things that we recognize is that when treating individuals for substance use disorders, you know, you have to treat the entire family. You know, the family can be, you know, a barrier or a facilitator to one's recovery and treatment. So we definitely know that, you know, you have to do a family history. You have to kind of understand the family dynamics to devise the best treatment plan and course of treatment for an individual suffering with substance use disorders.
But that seems such a momentous challenge, treating the entire family, assuming that there is a problem within the family. It sounds like a lot of times there are problems that expand beyond this one person. This one person isn't an outlier.
Mm-hmm. So what we mean by treating the entire family, it doesn't necessarily mean that all the family members have a problem with substance use disorder.
Right, right, exactly.
But you have to understand the family dynamics to see if it will have an influence, you know, on an individual's recovery. You know, will the family, you know, serve as a, you know, a barrier, or would they serve as a facilitator, you know, of treatment? So we definitely use a family approach.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Jonathan. What's on your mind?
Good evening. I'll be your guest. I'm a massage therapist for more than 20 years. I've been studying massage for more than 20 years as well. There's a lot of research at the Massage Therapy Foundation referencing massage therapy on chronic pain, and especially in patients who have opioid addiction. And I thought it was very interesting. Your guests talked about detox. Do you subscribe to manual lymphatic drainage as part of a detox regimen that would support that detox, if you understand what I'm talking about?
Lymphatic drainage? Is that what you said?
Yeah, lymphatic drainage massage.
Okay, so what is that?
That's, when you mentioned lymphatic drain massage, it sounds like you're, I know you said you just study massage therapy. That's the terminology that's used in that industry. For us, that would be considered more of an alternative mm-hmm. therapy. Traditionally, we, in inpatient units, it's typical. I can't speak for across the country,
right.
But, you know, we treat with medications. For substance use. As I mentioned earlier, there's medications such as buprenorphine, or also known as Suboxone treatment. Mm-hmm. Most people are familiar with methadone.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's intensive medical monitoring when you're in these hospital settings. Now, some hospitals offer some more experimental or
holistic
mm-hmm. yeah. Treatments. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it just depends on where you are and what access you have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting question, Jonathan. Thank you so much for your question. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Antonio, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to also comment on the fact that, you know, this is something to keep in mind with the money aspect of what's happening in this epidemic. And, you know, people who experience hardships and are prescribed these opiates, and the companies that gain so much financial capital from these things, and then how these things also matriculate into the street community, and those surviving in the street gaining capital off of these street versions of these drugs. And so, you know, I think it's very important, just like the previous caller said, to look at it from a social construct, but also from a policy construct. Mm-hmm. What can be done to eradicate these things and target these places that are extorting individuals, and also harming them.
Mm. Antonio, thank you so much for your comment. Daphne, when you are trying to meet people where they are and trying to get them off of these drugs, how do you do that? What are the conversations like? What is your strategy and approach?
Well, first, when I approach them, I let them know that I am a recovering addict, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to be perceptive to me if I'm not a recovering addict. Because first thing they're going to say, since I've been there, okay, what can you tell me? Okay, but I've been in your shoes, so I know the struggle. And that's how I'll be talking to them, right? And then I tell them about the program, and some of them might say, okay, I'm interested. I get the information, I write it down. Some of them might say they're not ready, and I still get them the information and just tell them when they're ready, you know, give me a call, right? But what I do, I keep going back visiting the same areas over and over again, so when they see my face, they know who I am. Some of them even come up to me and ask for a flyer, you know? But like I tell a lot of them, they ask me, how did I stay clean? I told them what I had to do first. When I stopped using, I had to see a psychiatrist because I had to find out, I had forgot why I was angry, why I was getting high. And I had to find out, I had to address that problem. So now I don't have a desire to get high anymore, because now I didn't seek that help. But a lot of people don't want to get help because they think if they see a psychiatrist, they think they're crazy. And I tell them that don't make you crazy, but you got to be crazy. You put something in your body and you don't know if you're going to live or die from it.
Mm.
And I was that person.
When
and I talked to them.
When did you finally say that enough was enough for you? What was that moment when you said to yourself, I can't continue to do this?
Well, my I had two sassy kids, so my first set, they was like grown, and they had kids, you know, and I believe if I would have paid more attention to my oldest daughter, you know, she would have had children, but probably not that early, you know, if I was being the mom that I'm supposed to be, you know. So when my daughter moved back home with me with her five kids, And my baby girl came back home, and her baby is 12 going on 13, and I'm 12 going on 13 clean. I got clean then, because what I did, I realized, like, what I had put my kids through, I didn't want to put my grandkids, because I said, man, these kids is off the hook. Why? Because they kept blowing my heart. And I was like, look, I gotta stop for the simple fact that I had got really caught up in my addiction. Even though when my kids were young, I wasn't bringing a lot of strangers in the house. But before my daughter moved with me, I was bringing strangers in the house. I was tricking, I ain't going north. You know, but when she moved in with me, I couldn't do that. So, you know, I had my bishop name is Darrell Lewis, and he asked me if God could do something for me right now, what I want him to do. And I'm like, God can't do nothing for me. He ain't do nothing for me all these years, so I'm going to give him a tough job. I asked him to change the taste buds in my mouth. So when I realized he had changed them, I haven't looked back since then.
That's really interesting, because I would imagine, you know, and we've been hearing this anti-drug strategy since at least Ronald Reagan, Nancy Reagan, and Just Say No, where the whole thing was, if we can reduce the desire for the drugs. And like I'm telling my age now, because that's kind of when you first started hearing about those strategies, where if you can reduce the desire, then that will help eradicate the broader problem of drug addiction. If they don't want it, they're not going to use it. But it's not that easy, is it?
But you have to address the problem, the issue. You have to address what got you there. See, you can get clean, and you can stay clean for years, but if you didn't address, if you didn't go to a psychiatrist and address the main issue, eventually you're going to pick back up.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, Dr. Waits, when you listen to what Daphne is saying, what role do you believe psychiatry plays in the whole addiction piece and recovery?
Well, it's really an interdisciplinary team that plays a role. You have psychiatrists, you have addiction specialists, which are physicians that can be from various backgrounds, but they specialize in working with patients with addictions. Then we have teams of social workers, peer recovery specialists. We all kind of collaborate from different angles to address working with that individual. So, for example, as Ms. Daphne mentioned, is that there's this, when you talk about the desire or, you know, you have to address those underlying issues, they kind of occur simultaneously, but from our perspective of using medications for opioid use disorder, we're addressing those biological aspects of addiction.
Explain the biological aspects.
So when you're dealing with addictions there, or when you're using substances, there's a biological mechanism that occurs when one becomes addicted, and that explains how medications are effective with treating, whether it's reducing one's cravings, reducing one's withdrawal symptoms. So it's helping them at least power through the challenges of what keeps them driving out to get high multiple times a day in some cases. So you have that, you have the doctors that are treating that aspect of it, but then you also want to treat what's going on psychologically, some of the trauma people are dealing with. As Daphne mentioned, people are self-medicating. they are people also, sometimes their environment has an impact on their recovery, meaning often we work with patients where they're like, yeah, you know, I'm not having the cravings, but every day when I walk outside, people are, you know, my supplier is right out there. It's hard. I don't want to go anywhere. We're trying to get them to engage in other activities, change their environment, do new things, but it's proliferated through their community. And so it's challenging.
I want to drill down a little bit more about the whole biological thing, is because this is fascinating to me. Is this, and let me preface this with, you know, my PhD comes from a Cracker Jack box, so I don't know, you know, but when we talk about, for example, alcoholism as a disease, mm-hmm. is, and you talk about the biological parts of this, is that also the disease part? So is it like some people who don't have the disease of alcoholism, they may drink, but they're not alcoholics, they don't, okay. Mm-hmm. Is that the same thing for those people who may not be susceptible to drug addiction because biologically, and I'm talking only about the physiological parts, that they don't have, you know, the physiological, you know, whatever, to be drug addicts?
So I think what you're getting at is some people, you know, there's a notion that some people are predisposed to addiction.
I don't know. I'm asking. Oh, yes.
There are some theories. That's one theory, that some people are more predisposed to addictions. And then, of course, the marriage of their environment may have an impact on that. However, when we talk about understanding the biological mechanisms behind addiction, there's something that happens in the brain with the reward center, or the reward they receive from using that substance multiple times. The first time, as Ms. Daphne mentioned earlier, how she tried different substances, mm-hmm. And then one wasn't working for her anymore, and then she moved on to PCP, and then eventually cocaine and heroin. And so often what happens is that the continued use of that drug has a almost devastating impact long term on one's brain makeup. So that addiction is always there, but you work on the recovery process mentally for your lifetime, you know.
And I think what makes it a disease is that it's a chronic relapsing condition.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, you know, it's not a matter of if you're going to relapse, but when, and people have multiple relapses before they actually recover fully from having an addiction disorder.
Mm. So, you know, with that said, you know, Dr. Kane, how do we move out of this epidemic? We know that this is a problem. We know that it has become more severe, more complex, and it seems
Some people are ashamed and afraid to come out and tell somebody that they got a problem because they think they're going to let somebody down, or their family don't know they're going to hurt their family. But, I mean, that's what holds a lot of us back, because then some of us think we don't have a problem. We mm-hmm. think because I get up and go to work, you know, and I pay my bills, and I can get high. But eventually, it's going to come to a day where you ain't going to be able to pay that bill. Because just like Dr. Wade said, it's something in the mind. And when you wake up that morning, it's going to click, and it's going to say, look, I need this because my body going to start aching, or I'm going to go through some withdrawal, so I'm going to have to stop everything I'm doing and go get high. It holds a lot of people back, just the shame and that guilt. And then a lot of people don't want to go into hospital. That's why Howard has a program right here at the D.C. Dream Center in the basement. And I've been telling my clients that. And we help you with transportation, getting there and back.
So, I do want to talk about that, which really kind of dovetails in what I was, you know, about to ask Dr. Kane. How do we move beyond where we are, getting information out, getting help getting services? Because I would imagine, and I could be wrong here, because Daphne just said these folks may not be sitting around watching TV, listening to the radio, reading online. They are looking for their next fix, their next high, and she is the Paul Revere, the messenger in the town square. But what's your take on moving us beyond where we are?
Right. Well, we recognize that, you know, certain communities are moving faster than others. You know, in the African American community, a lot of these novel treatments that are available now weren't available to us in the past. So we've been doing a lot of work to build trust, you know, around the use of these medications, doing education with faith leaders, educating, you know, providers, and even trying to encourage physicians and nurse practitioners to become prescribers, but as well as educate their patients about the efficacy of these medications. And so I think that, you know, we also have to train up the workforce because there's a growing demand for mental health and substance use services. So, you know, starting as early in our graduate professional schools by training and educating those that are in disciplines that will address, you know, alcohol and substance use, how to effectively implore treatments and to implore interventions that will be helpful to provide early intervention, as well as to provide, you know, intervention at any stage of someone's addiction and use.
What do those programs, and Daphne started talking about it, Dr. Waits, what do the programs look like at Howard? Because obviously, you know, Howard is in the middle of our community. And I would imagine that this would be a first step to getting help. But if people don't know, you know, without the definies of the world telling them, so what do the programs at Howard look like?
Okay, so we have launched programs under the umbrella of Howard University Center of Excellence for Behavioral Health. So our goal is to increase access to mental health and substance use treatment in underserved communities. And so particularly, we have a program in Ward 7. We treat people in Ward 7 in the surrounding areas, but we have a program down in Ward 7 at the DC Dream Center. So our goal was to provide treatment for opioid use disorder in a non-medical setting, remove some of the stigma. Like some people, just like Ms. Daphne said, some people are ashamed or they don't want to admit they have a problem. They're ashamed to go into a clinic. They don't want to come up to a traditional clinic and be seen going inside of a clinic that's known in the community for treating substance use disorder. So what we've done is we've provided a program in the community. So DC Dream Center is a multi-use community center. They have multiple programs for the community, after school programs, but we also have a treatment program there in one of the offices there where they can access addictions treatment via telehealth. We can, they're being followed by an addiction specialist from Howard University. They also will work with a recovery guide or a peer support specialist, so they can, you know, support them through that process of recovery. Address what's going on here inside the...
Right. And we also address some of the social determinants that also have an impact on substance use, such as housing. We provide case management. We help with other types of resources that the person may need so that they can recover well. And we also try to reduce some of the barriers to access, such as providing transportation. And by housing our programs within the community, as our good friend Pastor Curry says, people can heal in place. Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the DC Dream Center or anywhere, kind of walk me through, if I have a problem, if I am addicted and I go to, say, the DC Dream Center, and there is, you know, a Dr. Gloria Kane sitting at the desk, and I say, hey, I need some help, what is the first thing that you say? What is the first thing that you do? What happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely are, you know, very welcoming, because we know that it's very difficult to reach out for help. And then we try to understand the individual's perspective of their problem, because it'll best help us and inform us, you know, how to move forward. We do like a rapid assessment just to kind of.
What does that mean? Break that down for me.
So I guess with the rapid assessment, we just try to understand what their substance use history was like, what their drugs of choice are now that they're struggling with. And we just, you know, kind of do a preliminary assessment, and then we make provisions for them to see one of our psychiatrists through our telehealth portal. And then our psychiatrists, they're able to do like a further assessment and evaluation to determine if any of the treatments that we have that are medicinal, you know, will work well for them. And then depending on how that assessment, what the results are, you know, we might be able to refer them to a different program if our program is not like a good fit.
So, I mean, is this a 20-minute conversation? Is this a 30-minute conversation? Is it an hour? Am I sitting in an office? Are there other people around when, what?
Right. So we actually have our own space in the basement of the DC Dream Center. So we're able to see people, you know, in a private office. You know, they don't have to, you know, be seen by, you know, people in the community. They can come see us. They can check in, you know, anonymously, and, you know, people don't have to know that, you know, that they've been there. And it probably takes anywhere from like 30 minutes to an hour to, you know, kind of get them started. And then we also assess their other needs, such as, you know, whether or not they need case management services. We have two care management programs that we're able to connect people with as well. Because, you know, you can't treat substance use in a silo from other issues. So we try to address all of those different social determinants, because we know that it will have an impact on treatment and recovery.
How is inpatient treatment paid for?
So when you come in through the hospital system and you come in through the emergency room, so they're going to make sure that, you know, they address your acute medical needs. You know, many people have insurance, but they also treat people that are uninsured. So this, for inpatient detoxification, it's insurance is not the, should not be a barrier for someone to get treatment.
So when, in that detoxification process, you mentioned earlier that 2 or 3 days or however long it may take. Mm-hmm. I know there are all kinds of historically, there have been all kinds of, you know, with 30 days, you know. So once that person finishes inpatient, they finish detox, what happens then?
So their plan for when they're discharged from the hospital starts pretty much the day that they come into the program. So, you know, the doctors, the social worker on the unit are constantly meeting with the patient and say, hey, what are some things that you would like to happen when you leave the hospital? So the patient is engaged in the process. We link them with a care manager, as Dr. Kane mentioned. We have a care management program under the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health Services. So the goal is for the case manager to also follow up with them when they leave from the hospital. Now, you have some people who opt to go to 30-day programs or long-term, what they call residential programs. And so sometimes that's an option. Some people decide they want to attend an outpatient program. They may go to the DC Dream Center or go to our more traditional outpatient clinic that we have here at Howard University as well. And some people decide they don't want to do anything at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for those, and I'm speaking specifically for those who are at least taking those first steps, we realize, yes, there will be outliers. There are people even that, you know, Stephanie can't reach, but because she is there, she is still trying, because she has, you know, been there, done that, and wants to pull, you know, others into a success story. And with that said, Stephanie, I'll let you have the last word on this, if you have any final thoughts you'd like to share about this journey.
Well, All I can say is never too late. You know, it's always a chance that if you want it, it's there for you, and the help is here now. You know, and it's like War 7 and War 8 is struggling, but it's help there for us. You know, for the one that's still suffering. All I can say is I'm waiting on you. The number is 202-649-0359. Call me anytime.
What's that number again?
202-649-0359.
And that's your number?
It's the number for the program itself.
It's for the program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And the name of the... And what's the formal name of the program?
Better Together DC. I mean, Better Together HU.
Better Together... You sure, Dad?
HU. And that's our hashtag on Twitter and Instagram.
Yes. Better Together HU. I will make sure that I post that information on our website. Okay. And any other information that... we can share to help people be better together. Ladies, thank you so very much. I really appreciate your time. Daphne, hang in there. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, September 18th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.